The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein, live around the planet for our Clubland Q&A. It is 2 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 3 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 3:30 in Newfoundland and Labrador, 7 o'clock in London and Dublin, 8 o'clock in Paris and Berlin, 9 p.m. in Tallinn, Estonia, and Kiev, Ukraine, both of which we've had questions from in the last couple of weeks, 10 p.m. in the Trucial States, whence came a question the week before. Always like to get Trucial States questions. 10:30 p.m. in Kabul for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Afghanistan for the half-hour time zone. 11:45 p.m. in Kathmandu for all you Afghans who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. It's midnight in Almaty. And I don't think we had a question from there last week, so we would like one. It's a grim hour for our chums in Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific, but we hope at least a few of you will be with us. I'm going to be on 7-8 Radio in the UK for the audio edition of Stein's Song of the Week in a couple of hours. That's 9 p.m. London time. And a few hours after that, I'll be back right here for episode 19 of our current Tale for Our Time. I'm trying to think whether we got anything else to plug. Oh, yeah, next week, I'm going to be returning to UK telescreens for the first time in decades, a quarter century, a third of a century, whatever it is, since I guested on Muffin the Mule in 1958. Don't try Muffin the Mule at home, boys and girls. You know that's not a clever thing to try. I think there's a Muffin the Mule joke in The Prisoner of Windsor. If you haven't checked that out, the prospect of a Muffin the Mule joke 30 chapters in may tempt you. You know how this works. If you're a Mark Stein Club member, all you got to do is shoot me a question. And if you're not a Mark Stein Club member, there's 7 billion of your fellow humans around the planet who aren't Mark Stein Club members. But you're all welcome to listen anyhow. And I hope you do. But if you do want to sign up and ask me a question, we'll try and scoot you to the front of the queue, as they don't say in America. Let's see what we got here. Michelle Dulac. Michelle says, hi, Mark. Charles Blow has an op-ed piece in the New York Times this morning. That's your first mistake right there, Michelle. Charles Blow is not a columnist worth reading. You know, one thing I miss about Fleet Street I suppose it still is, actually, the most competitive newspaper market in the world. Toronto, I think, in the English-speaking world at least, was something of a close second. And one thing that meant was that they hired columnists on their ability to write. In American journalism, they have this thing of basically promoting reporters after they've been beat reporters for 30 years or whatever to columnists. So the op-ed page is always full of columnists with no brio. And if you want a brio-free zone, then Charles Blow's column is pretty much one of them. And I don't find it worth the reading. It's becoming a huge problem, even at magazines that used to be brilliantly written, like The Atlantic. But the unreadability of New York Times columnists is becoming a real issue. And Charles Blow is one of the worst, even by the pitiful standards of the New York Times op-ed page. Anyway, Charles Blow says that unmarried adults are shortly to become the majority in the U.S., and that we ought to be considering removing pro-marriage tax policies. He never defines these. And such, especially, he adds, as blacks are especially unmarried, circa 60% unmarried, versus a third or less for everyone else. Blow concedes that two parents are a help when raising children, but what about all the adults who don't have kids or whose kids are already grown? Is this another way of saying that the decline in childbearing is just a fait accompli and we should all get over it, or what? Well, that's the point. He's not a tax policy. Tax policies are not just for the people who are the beneficiary of those policies, but for everyone in society. You have tax policies because of objects that the overall society wishes to achieve. So you incentivize childbearing and two-person homes, because even if you're an elderly spinster, you're going to be dependent on social security and other forms of public benefits, living increasingly longer, maybe having dementia for the last 15 years of your life, and before finally keeling over at 103. So you're going to need young people raised in healthy two-parent families in order to provide a sound enough society in which people work and contribute to the exchequer and thereby generate enough income for the government to pay for the little old lady spinster living all alone until she's 112 or whatever. It's not very difficult, this. And actually, the strange present tense stupidity of the liberal worldview that you know, we love the moment. We are like Goethe's Faust. We just love this moment and we want to live in this moment forever. And it doesn't work like that. So, for example, if you have tax policies that disincentivize and obstruct the formation of families, you wind up with a screwed society. And nobody... The interesting thing here is that, for example... The marriage rate used to be, we didn't used to talk about marriage as a particular fetish of this or that identity group. The black marriage rate basically collapsed in the 1960s, not to the benefit of blacks. And so why the fact of that should be no reason to accept the permanence of that. And this, again, is that it's the arrogance of every generation to assume that the way it is the way it is always going to be. And the social indicators condemn our societies to violent death. The idea that having fewer middle-class families, raising families in intact households, in affordable homes, is now something we can do without is completely stupid. And I can't waste time anymore. I can't waste time with people. I'll tell you when it changed for me. Some of you will have heard this before, but it was 6 months, I think almost 6 months, not 6 months to the day, because 6 months to the day I was in New York City after 9/11. I think that's whatever it was, March the 11th, 2002. And I then went on a little fact-finding mission. I was going to the Middle East, and that can be a little bit depressing, so I thought I'd cheer myself up and go and look up a few old friends in continental Europe that I hadn't seen for a while. And I remember at one point, just as I said, before heading off to the Middle East, and I remember at one point I was in Vienna. And I always think of Vienna because I made a film for the BBC there that the Habsburg Empire was lost, but Vienna stayed on as an imperial capital, a great imperial capital without an empire. And you always thought of it as staying the same. If you went into record shops in Vienna, the bins on the main floor near the door were all full of operetta and waltzes. And if you were looking for any hip hop, you had to go downstairs and there'd be a box of it in the back of the basement. So you think of Vienna as a place that doesn't... People don't think of Vienna as a place that doesn't change. And I happened just to find myself waiting for somebody on a street corner, and he was 5 minutes late or whatever. And so I'm looking across the street, and there's people coming out of a maternity shop, and I noticed that all the people coming out of the maternity shop are obviously Islamic. So I went into the maternity shop, and all the people in there getting stuff for their forthcoming baby were Muslim in Austria, a place I didn't even really think of as having had much immigration. It was a multicultural centre, as we thought of it, until the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, it had Slovenes and Bavarians and Jews and Bohemians and Croats and all kinds of other people in there. But I didn't think of it as some place that had sufficient Muslim immigration to fill a maternity shop. And you suddenly, and once you see something like that, you can't unsee it. You realize that something, the future arrives, to use a line we've used too much in recent months and years, gradually and then suddenly. And you can see something underway gradually. And someone like, someone like these dreary Charles Blow columnists in the New York Times don't think about that. They don't think about that at all. Some of them do, the ones who actually are urging on the total destruction of America. I mean, I was looking at some of the responses to yesterday's Mark Stein show, and people are raising all kinds of topics, but basically everything people raise is about the destruction of what is. And it doesn't matter whether it's a critical US institution such as the military, which is being destroyed. It doesn't matter whether it's a pop culture icon such as Superman or James Bond that is being destroyed. The point is the destruction. Someone said, I think, if you want to have a gay superhero, why don't you create your own gay superhero? If you want to have a transgender secret agent, why don't you create your own transgender secret agent? Though, the point is to destroy Superman and to destroy James Bond. They're both peripheral in the scheme of things. But the point is there's nothing that escapes the left's attention. Sometimes it's something big like the US military, which is now a global laughingstock, pathetic. And the pom-pom right is still stuck in thank you for your service mode. They can't actually address the fact that it's now been co-opted by the wokest of the woke, and they're all laughing at you. So you got to get beyond the thank you for your service. Could you get a new bloody idea for the first time since Reagan left office? Pom-pom right, completely useless. Anyway, I don't want to get into that too early in the show. David says, I'm tired of the forced exclamation at the beginning of public gatherings like graduation, sports events, symposia, beheadings, etc., that we are currently standing on the land of Tribe A or Tribe B. I think David must be writing from Canada, because this is a particular problem in Canada, and I think it started during the Justin Trudeau years. I think David Johnston, the Governor General, started doing it whenever he did anything at Rideau Hall. I forget which Indian tribe previously inhabited Rideau Hall, a government house in Ottawa, the residence of the Viceroy. But if he was there, we stand here on the land of, I had to testify to the House of Commons with the whatever it is, the House of Commons Justice Committee over their plans to reintroduce hate speech. And the actual Parliament is or was closed for renovations. So they were sprucing it up a bit. So they moved the committee into a block across Wellington Street that used to, I think, be the Allied Insurance Building. And I was thinking of beginning my remarks with a land acknowledgement and saying that you're there on ancient Abenaki land. We were there on ancient Allied Insurance Company land. David says, it now appears that some indigenous folks are getting tired of this charade too. Because they say, I ought to say charade, actually. I'm going on UK telly next week, so I've got to remember the Britannic pronunciation. So I should say charade. When we played our charade. Are getting tired of this charade too, because they sense the sincerity of it all with internet memes borrowing from the idea for the pleasure of Gen XYZ, XYZ users. Can we all agree that this improves the lives of indigenous peoples not one iota and is merely another genuflection of guilt by the wacko white left? And of course it is this same group that will accept undocumented and unfounded claims of the indigenous peoples but totally reject Israel's claim to be the Jewish homeland despite thousands of years of documented existence. Funny that. Well, it actually goes beyond that, David, because For example, I mean, the left, you're making the mistake here of looking for consistency in the left. The reason they do these Aboriginal land acknowledgements in places like North America and Australia or New Zealand is because they want to remind you that Americans and Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders are usurpers of the land who have no legitimate right to be there. That's their position. And one way of formalizing that is to get leaders to do these Aboriginal land acknowledgements. Because the presumption, if you try to do it in your street, if you go two doors down the road to Mrs. Jones's house and begin your talk by saying, I acknowledge that I'm standing here on the ancient land of the Jones family, Mrs. Jones will say to you, what the hell are you doing in my house? And so the point of those acknowledgements is to delegitimize the white man's presence in the United States and the British settler nations. And so it works. So they land acknowledgement. We acknowledge that we stand here on the ancient land of the Algonquin Indians, blah, 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 blah. But on the other hand, then, if you're in, say, Western Europe, nobody does land acknowledgements. You wouldn't bother to do. I mentioned the other day some of these amazing statistics, like the London Borough of Newham, where 75% of births are to women from outside the UK. No, nobody would say, oh, if they were giving a talk in Newham, we acknowledge that we stand here on the ancient land of the Cockney people. They're dead. They're going into the garbage can of history, and good riddance to them. Nobody in Malmo says we stand here on the ancient land of the Swedish people, because they're going into the garbage can of history, and good riddance to them. Nobody in Marseille. It's only... You shouldn't make the mistake of looking for consistency in the left. You should just slap this stuff down. It wasn't their land. As David says, they were semi-nomadic. In my part of New Hampshire, basically the Indians showed up, they ate everything they could eat, left a wasteland, and then moved on. Now, they'd had centuries to develop a more lasting civilization and build the kinds of cities that you saw all over the world, and they didn't do it. They didn't do it. And nobody in their right mind, well, actually nobody, people in their wrong mind, because all these crazy wokesters don't actually want to live like a Native American did. They don't actually want to live like an Australian Aborigine did. The hypocrisy of this. But again, it's very important. Ideologically, it's between two groups of whites, one of which stands against the Western civilizational inheritance, sometimes just for shallow reasons, because they think it's hipper, they think it's cooler. And other times for psychologically more complicated reasons that they actually loathe. The world they live in, they actually loathe. They everything, if you were in the average suburban subdivision, if you're in the average American college campus and you remove everything that the evil white privileged people did, there wouldn't be a lot around. But it's the lack of consistency. They're not bothered by that. So they'll do the land acknowledgement thing in Canada to remind you that you're a usurper. You shouldn't even be here. And it bolsters all this thing, oh, land of immigrants. Unless we're all immigrants, unless you're a Native American, unless you're one of the first peoples. The fact that they came over the Bering Strait from where? I mean, who cares? The point is, the East Coast colonies were among His Majesty's dominions, and people moved from one corner of His Majesty's dominions to another corner of His Majesty's dominions. They were settlers. They weren't immigrants. And all this talk is just rubbish. Dan Phillips says, not unlike the George Floyd episode, I'm waiting for the event, which hopefully will spark civil unrest among the unwashed. It's very interesting, Dan. We can't vote our way out of everything that's going on. And so People are saying, well, in that case, what do you do? Well, there's things you can do. You could argue your corner in the education system, in the mainland churches, on mainstream television networks, in motion pictures, in novels, in plays, in pop songs. But one side of the question is shut out from almost all those aspects of life. And it doesn't leave a lot else except a shooting war. And of course, the issue here is most people in the George Floyd business, most people who lead productive lives do not want to be in the street smashing things. They understand at a certain level that the things that work for them, you know, your salary arriving mysteriously in your bank account every month by wire transfer, that these things require civilized functioning societies. And the first thing you do, like when you have one side looting and rioting, the other side tends to dig in and try to maintain social order even more because they want to keep those wire transfers coming. They want things like the telephone networks and the electricity still to work and everything. Nobody who has any investment in society, such as a home or children, wants to destroy that society, which is why when you look at these people on the streets, or even these people at the Netflix protest, my God! I said before, I have a real antipathy. I'm relaxed, having been around show business all my life, about the trans phenomenon generally. There's always been a bit of it. That I don't think it works particularly well outside show business, and I wouldn't advise anyone who's not in show biz to give it a go. But I am incredibly antipathetic to bad trannies. And if you look at those people protesting whatever it was outside Netflix, they're Netflix employees, and that is like the bad tranny of the year competition. But these are people, again, it's what happens when you send everyone to college. So you have people who are school children until they're 28, who are living with their parents until they're 30. So they don't have a home, they don't have families, they don't they're not contributing members of society in that way. And you know, I'm not saying anything I haven't said in books and things. I think what matters is the up to grade 8. And the phenomenal success of the United States was the success of an 8th grade America. As I always say, in 1940, the average American had an 8th grade education. Because if you get the first 8 grades right, you've got people who are ready to contribute to the world. If they want to stay on and go to university, they should be doing a real academic discipline. And if you look at it that way, we bugger up the first 8 grade so that we think we can make up for the fact that generally by the time someone starts high school in America, they don't know anything. And we think that therefore the secret is to keep them there longer and longer and longer. But the longer and longer they're in the system, the further and further and further they fall behind compared to other developed nations, or most critically to China. So the whole thing is a racket like that. And eventually what will happen is that the, which you see in all civil strife around the world, is that either the other side will adopt the tactics of the radicals, or they will agree to go quietly into that dark night. Now, we've had some discussion in our comment section about the Second Amendment, and Kate Smythe, our Australian sign clubber, you know, keeps saying, well, OK, when is this Second Amendment going to kick in? The government said, for example, they were going to, if you had more than $600 in your bank account, you're going to need to go through the government. The government's been holding political prisoners in Washington since January the 6th. At some point, one of two things are going to happen, despite the Second Amendment. Either people are going to take to the streets, and we are going to have an armed insurrection, or people are going to agree to go quietly into long and endless night. And as I used to say, I used to worry there'd be a civil war, and now I worry there won't be one. Eric Dale writes, "Hello, Mark and fellow club members. Does America, and possibly the rest of the West in general, suffer from a crisis of competence? Take the late Colin Powell, for example." That's like the Henny Youngman joke. Take my wife, please. Take Colin Powell, please. From when he emerged to public prominence during Operation Desert Storm to when he was Secretary of State in his later years, we were told this is the quintessential member of our elite. Educated, accomplished, a steady hand to steer the ship of state. Yet he was the face of the case for the invasion of Iraq and their WMD program. Despite the assurances of our money is no object intelligence services, we found out that the main reason for the war, the WMD program, was a giant bluff after the invasion. Not to pick on Colin Powell specifically, but it's been one blunder after another with our elites. From trade policies that made communist China a global superpower with apparent technological parity to our own when they were an economic backwater within living memory, to funding the gain-of-function research that may have given rise to the COVID pandemic. Our best and brightest in power just keep getting it wrong on the questions that matter. How can we change this situation? Well, we have a closed elite, which is often the problem with dysfunctional societies. You could make the same case about the upper ranks of Ottoman Turkey, for example. A healthy society, you have, obviously, any society tends towards an elite, but it has to be a socially enough fluid elite that you're getting new blood coming in and out of it. Now, for example, on our Sunday poem, I mentioned Matthew Prior. Matthew Prior was the son of a joiner. He wasn't an aristocrat in that. We did a poem by Matthew Prior. He's born the son of a joiner. He's not someone who was born in a high and lofty position, but he became a valued counselor to the king and a top diplomat, and is credited with negotiating the Treaty of Utrecht, which isn't bad for the son of a joiner. So that even in a society we think of as far more socially stratified than contemporary America, there's a degree of fluidity that enables people to progress in, and likewise for untalented people, such as most of our guys, to drop out of it. Now we have a situation where they all marry each other, they all rotate between Goldman Sachs and government and the stint as a contributor on CNN or ABC or whatever. It's a closed world. They're all circulating within it, and they're not very good. And they've got almost every... Now, for example, as you say, China was an economic backwater within living memory. It was our elites who chose to make it the global superpower. So they now got space nukes. I don't know what we're going to do about that, because in a sense, you know, space nukes is one of those things where if you're willing to do it, the chances are you're also probably willing to use it. So that's not a small thing, China getting space nukes. Then we have this so-called gain-of-function research. That's where, to put the best face on it, the American end of it were the rubes, as they were with giving China all our manufacturing and then all our knowledge economy. Now, let's say this guy Fauci is not actually a mass murderer, that he didn't actually intend to kill millions of people around the planet, and it was all benign and accidental, and he seriously thought that that Wuhan was just a nice place, quiet place to get on and do a bit of coronavirus research. In that case, he's an idiot. That's the best construction you can put upon it. I mean, the one thing that's clear, whatever is the ultimate truth of the origins of the virus, once they knew they had it, the Chinese weaponized it. I don't think it's actually possible to do that. When you look at the timeline and you look at how fast it traveled around the world, and you look at what China was doing on the ground, these campaigns in Milan to hug a Chinaman and all the rest of it. When you look at all that, regardless of the origins, the weaponization of it was conscious. so that we're all going to be living with it, all our countries, for the foreseeable future. That's a huge advantage to China, particularly because of the risk aversion of our society. So we keep going in and out of lock. Oh, there's a new variant. There's one in the UK. Did I read this right? It's a variant of the variant. I don't know. Even the variants are having variants now. But the point about that is, that is on Fauci. These elites doing stupid things all the time. It's not that all societies tend to be governed by elites. You know, the Marquess of Salisbury didn't wind up as prime minister only because he was a marquess, but being a marquess helped. The problem now is that we have incredibly incompetent and stupid, self-protecting and too enclosed in elites. And certain ideas, the idea that, I mentioned the other day that I'd been called in by presidents and princes and prime ministers to talk about my demographic thesis. And they heard it, and a lot of them said interesting things about it. But it's not something within, you know, essentially we're governed by people who are like a particularly boring NPR program. You know those programs where you switch on NPR. You don't have to switch on NPR. I'm sure you've heard this on lots of equivalents around the world. But you switch on National Public Radio. And they're talking to some undocumented immigrant living in the shadows. And the undocumented immigrant living in the shadows is explaining, you know, how difficult it is because he came to America and he can't become fully American. And so he's trapped living between two cultures. And you think to yourself, I really like this show and I really enjoyed it when I heard it with an entirely different immigrant 3 years ago and some other immigrant 7 years before that. And the first immigrant I heard talking like this 37 years ago. And everything among our elites is stuck in that awful dead zone of good taste received opinion. So that something that is things for a start, and this applies to conservatives too. Conservatism finds things like the laughing stock of the U.S. military is simply too difficult to comprehend for the pom-pom girl, thank you for your service kind of conservatism. The loss of Afghanistan, which has disappeared from the news because America being a crapped out loser is a concept that American conservatives don't like to deal with. It's psychologically complex. And so that's the difficulty. So we have, when we have elites running things, the problem is that the broader culture that sustains them won't admit any of the real issues. Now, that's before you get to all these people in the elite who are actually just openly working for the Chinese. I mean, the fact is, if Fauci wasn't working for the Chinese, what exactly would he be doing that's any different? That's the problem. Michael Cavino says, "Hi, Mark, your old colleague, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, told the United Nations this week the world needs to grow up and tackle the climate change crisis." Yeah, because nothing says how much you've grown up, Boris, than saying everything your missus tells you to say. Here's a Paul quotation. "We will see desertification, drought, crop failure, and mass movements of humanity on a scale not seen before, not because of some unforeseen natural event or disaster, but because of us, because of what we are doing now," says Boris. "Perhaps this explains our open southern border. Has COVID caused him to go off the deep end? And why not address his complaints to biggest polluters such as China and India rather than the UN? Can we please send him a copy of your book, Climate Change, the Facts to Allay His Climate Fears? On the music fronts, any thoughts on the release of the Beatles' Let It Be box sets? The content on the website just gets better and better. Thank you for informing and entertaining us in the age of stupidity. Best regards," says Michael. Look, the thing about that, mass movements of humanity on a scale not seen before. I did a signpost on this on what Steve Saylor calls the most important graph in the world, showing what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa and in the population explosion there. So that countries that can't really support 6 million people are going to have upwards of over 60 million people. When I talk about this, I use some things that are easy to grasp. The fact that the population of the British Isles in the 1920s, England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and the and West Africa, British West Africa, were exactly the same. And now Nigeria alone has exploded. And if you take in everything, it's many times the population of the British Isles, what was British West Africa. And the fact is, it's nothing to do with climate change. They've all got cell phones and they see what life is like in Sweden and Germany. And so they're getting on ships and making that little short journey across the Mediterranean. And then wherever they land, the object is to get into the big, generous Northern European welfare states. That's nothing to do with climate change. And okay, Mr. Butch Boy, you suddenly want to talk about the mass movements of humanity on a scale not seen before. We've got that now. And you can't do anything about it now. So it's all to do with climate change. We've got to lower the temperature of the planet by the year 2200 or whatever you want to do. It's going to be too late for that. I can't stand this. Like a guy who he has the advantage of sitting on an island, which is a great help in immigration things. And he can't keep the invaders off his island. So why would we take any lessons from him on how to save the planet? Save your own bloody country. You're the Queen's First Minister. Get off your ass and save your country. Pathetic. Let's calm down a bit. I'm getting too worked up. So let us calm down a bit, and I'll pause for a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back. Alan Wilmot died a couple of days ago at the age of 96. He was a Jamaican, and he joined the Royal Navy in 1941, and then after the war, he took the Empire Windrush to England. And he formed a vocal group of singing Jamaicans called the Southlanders. This was their big song. Alan Wilmot's brother Harry on the title phrase. Harry Wilmot was the father of the boundlessly genial British entertainer, star of West End shows, Gary Wilmot. Lovely man. If you're going to have just one big song, this is not a bad one to pick. And its hook will be with you for the next fortnight. Ba 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 ba.
I'm not a bat or a rat or a cat. I'm not a gnu or a kangaroo. I'm not a goose or a moose on the loose.
I am a mole and I live in a hole.
I'm not a cow or a chow or a sow.
The Southlanders. I am a mole and I live in a hole. That's one for all the Chinese agents burrowed deep within the United States government. Rest in peace, Alan Wilmot, dead at 96. You're listening to Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A, live around the planet, taking questions from Mark Stein Club members wheresoe'er you may happen to dwell. And I thank you for all those questions. John Taylor says, hello, Mark. Any thoughts on why the Chinese seem to be waiting to begin their inevitable attack on Taiwan? What are they waiting for? The US military is so deeply distracted by self-parody, as you accurately describe, that I cannot imagine it will get any better for the Chinese. Perhaps they're waiting to let loose their next biological attack on the world so that we're all well occupied with more masks and lockdowns and vaccination squabbles when they make their move. With the lump in the White House, I consider a Chinese attack on Taiwan to be a fait accompli, but they do seem to be dragging their feet. Are they worried that such a move will reveal who they really are to the 24 people around the globe still in doubt, says John. Well, you know, the whole strategy of the Chinese has been to take over the world by stealth, which they have largely succeeded in doing. So in other words, they're not playing the same games that traditional great powers play. They're doing something actually far more cunning. And that's one reason it presents a challenge. Now, we're just self-absorbed nincompoops. So the fact that we're descending into self-parody isn't terribly important to them in that scheme. You know, I was a foreign correspondent, in effect, for part of my life, and I used to write about the United States for other places, for the Telegraph papers in London, for the National Post in Canada, for chaps like the Australian in Australia, and also for, you know, India and South Africa, and because people were interested in America, because what America did then seemed consequential. Now, what America does doesn't seem in the least bit consequential. And something like Bagram Air Base, which in our imagination is at the fringes of the map. It's at the part of the map where it says, here be dragons. But actually, if you look at the world as is, That's actually smack in the center of the map. You've got Russia to the north, you've got China to the east, you've got Iran to the southwest, you've got Pakistan just down the road, and could make a more plausible claim for being the place the Greenwich Meridian should be running through and setting the world's time by than Greenwich, and certainly than Washington, D.C. And the Chinese assume that America, you can't do America, you can't take America seriously. So you've got to, apparently we have a music track playing under, is that correct?
Oh, Mark Stein's Q&A begins live across the planet in 5 minutes.
We'll see what we can do about that. Sorry, that's playing under. I'm trying to see what I can do to get rid of that. Has it gone away now? Hello? Hello? Has it gone away now, the music playing under? Okay. Has it gone away? Thank you. that's my... I should just retire, actually. This is embarrassing, this technical fiasco. Maybe I should just retire. But I think that's the reason that they know that they look on America as just I'm becoming an example of American decline here myself. I think they look on it. I think if you look at it that way, that the Bagram Air Base is actually the center of the world where the future is being made. To the north, Russia. To the east, China. To the south, west, Iran. And just on the doorstep, Pakistan, that this is where the future is being made. And Europe and North America are irrelevant to that future. And Europe is just old and dying and a pleasant little old aunt who sits on her rocker, obsessing like Boris does about climate change. And America is like the crazy aunt. The crazy aunt, and you wish she's there in the ward. Uncle Sam is trying to transition into Auntie Samantha and is doing a laughably bad job of it, but she clearly has some mental issues, and you're best to just leave her walled up in the ward, talking to herself, obsessing on crap and trivia all day long, from both sides of the political aisle. I mean, I saw a statement from Paul Ryan that had evidently been written for him by some writers, and it was the trivia of it. You know, he's saying, oh, he promised to govern as Kirsten Sinema, and in fact, he's a Bernie bro. Oh, that's brilliant, Paul Ryan! That's fabulous, that. Nobody in America knows who Kirsten Sinema is. Nobody knows who Joe Manchin is. The biggest group of people are people who tune out of politics, 26% in this poll I saw, because I would imagine, because it's too toxic. A, it's too toxic, and B, from the right's point of view, it isn't about anything. So I look at this thing. I think the Chinese are on their own time on this. And John, that's when it's when it's going to, you know, really when it suits them. That's when it will go. William Fleischman writes. William says, "Dear Mr. Stein, before I get started, I must say I loved your rendition of The Soldier by Rupert Brooke. For some reason, it brought to mind the painting by Percy Moran depicting Sir Edward Pakenham and Andrew Jackson squaring off at New Orleans. New Orleans may be a Democrat slum, but I take comfort that at least somewhere beneath New Orleans, drive-by shootings, corruption, and transsexual hookers is a grave, or many graves, that is forever England with a richer dust concealed. Now to business. I think that the solution to our problems is the formation of a national Congress in the mould of the Indian National Congress, consisting of a leadership that will advocate and agitate for peaceful separation from the United States. Such an organisation would organise protests, boycotts, acts of civil disobedience if need be, and other forms of subversion until we achieve our political objectives, a corner of the United States that is ours. I believe that you and your listeners, as well as writers like yourself, Peter Brimelow, Jared Taylor and John Derbyshire, and anyone else who wishes to participate, should meet at the V-Dare Castle in Berkeley Springs, and organise a strategy to achieve peaceful separation. I'm not sure I'd be actually that welcome among that company. I think at least two of them think I'm a big wussy. I haven't seen Peter Brimelow. I had a convivial lunch with him and John O'Sullivan and Bob Tyrrell from the American Spectator in Montreal. They used to do a show that was filmed up in Montreal. I think it was called The Editors. It was on PBS, I think, in America. And impossible to imagine any of those guys getting on PBS these days. But it was different back then, quarter century ago. And what I mostly remember about that lunch is that Peter told a very funny story about one of these gentlemen who likes to insert gerbils where it's ill-advised to insert gerbils, and it had not worked out well for him. You know, the famous film star who is alleged to be into that. And I think that's good. You know, we're talking about green policies, progressive policies. I think it's good to actually, you know, all these people who profess to be concerned about species and animals, I think it's actually doing something very practical, opening an animal sanctuary in your own bottom. It says a lot for a chap. Anyway, where was I now? Oh yes, this was William Fleischman's suggestion for an Indian National Congress, and I think actually this is a very good idea, and I'll tell you why. Because this, I keep trying to think, what does this remind me of? And I suddenly realised that it reminded me of something going back to my boyhood, where I watched occasionally at first hand the decolonization of the British Empire. And the first generation of colonial leaders were very famous figures. They were on the news nightly in London and in Ottawa and in Canberra, they were as famous as the UK and Australian and Canadian prime ministers. I'm talking about Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia and Julius Nyerere in Tanzania and Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. And what you noticed was that some of them were relaxed about statues of Queen Victoria or Cecil Rhodes or whoever it happened to be. And others weren't. And others had a need to destroy and actually to actively to destroy a lot of the colonial past, including things that, you know, matter, such as the rule of law. And that's what you see. And it's understandable, I think, in a way. If you're in East Africa, if you're in what was Tanganyika, and you have all this heritage of Britain and you regard it as foreign, as the white man's heritage, and you want to destroy it. And I can sort of understand why you would feel like that, even, as I said, if the more sensible people were more relaxed about it and left up the statue of Queen Victoria and lived a slightly ambivalent life, acknowledging this glorious inheritance and recognizing that it would be deeply damaging to destroy it, even as they were also trying to build societies that were less British in their characteristics. And that's what we see now. The fanaticism about tearing down statues of Confederate generals and then extending it, as they did in New York, to remove a statue of Thomas Jefferson. So in other words, New York City is taking down statues of Thomas Jefferson as if it's some African backwater, and the guy who's the first post-colonial leader is attempting to show that he's the local strongman, and it's year zero and history begins with him. Except the difference here is that for the most part, it's progressive whites destroying and trashing their own inheritance. And it reminds me exactly of what it's like of those colonial times, except, which is what is so utterly preposterous, it's American whites destroying what American whites have built. But the similarity to what happened in post-colonial Africa and other places has struck me. But the idea of the Indian National Congress that William Fleischman says, I mean, there's a different thing here. The Indian National, Gandhi and the gang were up against British civil servants. And if you're going to pick an enemy to have, British civil servants is a good one to pick, because they're not generally as blood-soaked as most other potential enemies you can have. And if you look at, now you might make that calculation here, but actually if you look at US court decisions, if you look at what's happened to those January 6th protesters banged up in solitary without bail since January the 6th for a trial for which no date has yet been scheduled. In other words, if you look at the 30 stinking, rotten, corrupt federal justice system, you know that any equivalent to the Indian National Congress would have a much tougher fight on its hands than Gandhi and the gang ever did. And that's before you get to things like a corrupt attorney general. There's a story in the New York Post today that, in fact, the attorney general who has now sent the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt FBI G-men after mommies who object to critical race theory at municipal school board meetings. Okay, so much for your federalism there. Merrick Garland's son-in-law is actually the guy who's running the whole critical race theory racket. So it's all very, that's again, that self-protecting elites. You can't question the Attorney General's son-in-law's critical race theory boondoggle, because he'll send the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt G-men after you. So the Indian National Congress would be a trickier thing to pull off in a federal government that would have no problem doing to you what it did to say those guys at where, oh, there's kids being abused in that cult, so let's go in and kill all the kids, and then they won't be being abused anymore. And she got away with that, Janet Reno. You know, so that there's a tradition here that at some point it's going to come to firepower, and they can bring more firepower to bear, and that's the thing. But the essential idea here, the Indian National Congress, I think is right. Nobody, and actually, as we go along here, the best way to save the United States right now would be for a serious movement to break it up. It doesn't necessarily mean you don't have to. You just say you want to break it up. You want to break Canada up. I mean, I do believe that right now the freest societies to live in are going to be the smallest. We've seen what's happening in Central and Eastern Europe. The idea that a centralized nation of 350, 400 million people can stay free is ridiculous. In Canada as well, I think the sheer size means that a lot of people would be happier in an independent province of 2 million people than in an ever increasingly closed down, locked down nation of whatever it is, 35, 40 million people. So the small nations thing are the place to go to start a serious movement about that. Now, in the end, what you're trying to do is apply pressure to the government to keep certain ideas in play, like federalism. The demand you start with, like we want to partition the United States and have a separate country. But we all know, let's be honest, American liberals hate American conservatives and want us to die. But the fact is that that's not going to happen anytime soon, and you don't yet quite have the guts to actually come and kill us all. But we hate each other, so why stay in the same country? We'd like to separate and start our own country. Now, you can do that and then agree to settle for something else, or settle for something that leads to that, or settle for a genuine federalism with a central government that has far more minimal powers and all the rest of it. But you have to put that on the table. Even, on the 100 Years Ago show, we're following closely the developments that led to the Irish Free State, which was so called because of the Orange Free State and what had pre-Ireland been Britain's most His Majesty's most querulous dominions in South Africa. And so the idea that you have you say, oh yeah, we want to become a republic, and we don't want anything to do with the British Empire. And then in 1922, you agree to settle for dominion status equivalent to Canada or whatever. And so you can settle for other things, but you have to put the demand on the table. And I think what's going on now, and again, the right isn't much use in this because it's such a perversion of the Constitution. No way would any of the guys who drafted that Constitution recognize these United States, where you're now having a school board in some village in northern New Hampshire. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has the right to come riding into town and grill the soccer mom for objecting to the critical race theory propounded by the Attorney General's son-in-law. Do you think the founders of the United States would recognize that crap hole as America? Of course they wouldn't. So it would be great. It would be great to actually say, look, something is underway here. We had a good run. But a nation of 400 million people that hates each other is going to be bloody and violent and vicious and just hell to live in. So why don't we negotiate some kind of divorce now? And the other thing I would say, while we're talking about this, William, that's a good solution for the particular problem of America. But we had this mentioned the other day about we need a rebirth of romantic nationalism. what John Howard, the Australian Prime Minister, described to me as an heroic national narrative. And if you have got an heroic national narrative, then you have a duty to pass it on to your children. We don't. Instead, we teach them to hate the country, and then we're surprised that what started in the schools, what started on the college campuses, mysteriously spreads so that it's all over Netflix. It's all Walmart, which the boobs at National Review put on the cover of the magazine with the headline America's Store. And they teach critical race theory now. So they sell Chinese crap and teach critical race theory, but to National Review readers, they're America's Store. So it's spread everywhere. And what and putting on the table, what is this going to look like 5-10 years' time? Do you want to be in it 5-10 years' time? No? Then let's start a movement for those who still believe in a romantic nationalism, who still believe in America, of retaining somewhere an America that approximates to the old America. And maybe the comparison isn't to the Irish South, but to the Irish North, that as one part of your country becomes something other, and you don't want to be part of that, then you have to accept less, a smaller amount of geography in which to maintain a particular idea of your state as it was. And the other thing I would say is that we need to counter globalism with a global nationalism. People always thought that Donald Trump's Make America Great Again, it was always presented in the mainstream media as somewhere pissing on other countries. He got on great with other leaders, much better in some ways than Joe Biden does, who's just a dead husk being led around by Dr. Jill. But he advocated for himself what he advocated for others. I mean, he was in favor of making America great again. He was in favor of making Sweden great again. He was in favor of making Belgium great again. He was in favor of making Tuvalu great again. It was, as our common to put it, an internationale of nationalisms. And I think that's, again, we have to learn from each other. Right now, Monsieur Zemmour is making a lot of noise in France, and he's certainly talking about more important things than the boobs of the Republican Party. And it helps. It helps to actually say, oh, you know, that French idea is rather good, but that French idea isn't. So we'll use French idea A and not French idea B. And maybe if we take French idea A, and then we've got down here, we've got Australian idea C, that might be useful too. And the Australians might in turn say, oh yeah, these guys in America have come up with something. So we a parochial nationalism isn't going to work, but an alliance of nationalists is going to work. I got a bit long on that, William, but to reiterate your main point, it has come time for an Indian National Congress to ask for things it might not get in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, but it ought to be putting them on the table. Let's see now. We're getting toward the end of our show, and I'm trying to see if I've got anything to plug because I got so into the big topics. So, yeah, I'm going to be with you in an hour or so in on 7-8 Radio in the UK, and then back here later for Tales for Our Time. And next week, as I mentioned, I'm going to be on GB News on your telly for all you Anglo-Celts, demographically demolished as you might be. But for any who are left, I'm going to be on GB News, and for anybody else in the vicinity. You can watch it from anywhere in the world, I believe, by going to gbnews.uk. And I'm going to be on there next week and looking forward to it very much. On Tuesday, Leslie Bricus died. And yesterday we played one of his number one hits, The Candyman. This song wasn't a hit. It came from a terrible flop film, a musical version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, made by people who had no idea about musicals, although they were very talented, but no idea about musicals. So as a musical, it was a disaster. Except for the songs, it was with Peter O'Toole and Petula Clark, and Pet kept singing this song. She's kept singing it through the decades, and her reading of it has deepened and intensified. If you ever get the chance, if the lockdown ever lifts sufficiently for Pet to come to your town, do make sure you go and see her sing this. When I was young, I didn't care for it, but as I've grown, it's grown on me. Here is Petula Clark on TV duetting with Anthony Newley. Words and music by Leslie Bricus, the late Leslie Bricus, who died on Tuesday.
Now we're going to sing a Bricus song, right? I'm on the wrong side. Do you mind if I go around the other side?
Who starts? Well, let's do a dramatic opening at the piano.
Start, do it the way you used to do it. You used to start singing.
Okay. These words go. You and I have traveled far together. We've pursued our little star together. We are happy as we are together.
We may never get to heaven, but it's heaven at least to try.
You and I are going on together, till the time we have is gone together. Watch the evening drawing on together.
Growing older, growing closer,
making memories that light the skies
that only time can make.
That only love can make.
That only time we have is gone together.
What's the evening drawing on together?
Growing older,
growing closer,
making memories that light the sky that only time can make.
That only
Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.